James Mann has done us the honor of joining us in conversation. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. Bill Russell.
What you're doing is history, and things, events don't make sense out of their context.
Yep.
And what you've done is contextualize them. I still think we're struggling with Magna Carta.
Mm.
So a failure to go back and attend to what's actually going on out there, what's happened, is a failing. You go back to the post-war era, beginning with the various people who have exercised influence. You talk about the wise man, mm-hmm. who came out of Wall Street, out of law and finance,
and the role they played. And this is in World War
II. Well, coming out of the war, but also during the war. I mean, they were advisors to Roosevelt and had roles in his administration. And then we go to the best and the brightest, which tend to be academics. And then we go to the Vulcans, who, wonder of wonders, and the irony of it, who basically are career bureaucrats,
mm-hmm.
which for a group of people who part of their underlying perspective is a rejection of the role of government, is extraordinarily odd. I mean, the irony of that is striking. But it seems to be and this goes to the current political condition, how we got into what we're into, and how, looking forward, we can have an impact.
Which we,
the sovereign people of this country, as well as the leaders we select, and how we evaluate them and how we discuss them publicly and privately, and it seems to be that those flows are dead center of how we end up behaving the way we behave, making the decisions we make, and really how we ended up in the ditch we're in now economically.
Well, and it has direct implications for what happens on Tuesday when Joe Schmo gets out of bed or not.
Well, let me say it a little different. Yeah, I try to write about generations of foreign policy officials and where do they come from. So this is a group of Wall Street bankers at the end of World War II who are America's foreign policy leaders at the beginning of the Cold War. The Kennedy years, yeah, it's a group of people where the center of the administration really is Cambridge, Massachusetts. That's where people are from. The Vulcans, and we should say, I think, for people watching, the Vulcans was the name that the George W. Bush foreign policy team gave to itself during the campaign before he won office. So it's people
it's named for a statue under which we lived for a number of years that what nobody mentioned was falling apart.
Right. That's the statue in Birmingham, Alabama. But it's people like Cheney, Rumsfeld, also Colin Powell, Richard Armitage, but the whole team of people who had served in previous Republican administrations and were coming back into office
in
2001. And
I didn't maintain contacts through.
Right. And what I try to say is, again, all of these people, the common denominator is had served in the Bush, Reagan, or Ford administrations, even Nixon for Rumsfeld. But the common denominator is prior service. But where had they served? The real locus of where did people come from was the Pentagon. It didn't matter whether, which wing of the George W. Bush administration you were from. Your familiarity with foreign policy came from the military, either as a civilian military person, that's Rumsfeld or Cheney or Wolfowitz, or as a career military official like Colin Powell. But one way or another, I mean, even Condoleezza Rice's first job in Washington was in the Pentagon. That's where people got their training and their familiarity. And you look ahead now, this is still a little bit of a problem. If you look at the Obama administration, you find a remarkable number of career military people in senior government positions. Now, this doesn't say anything about their views, but that's where people come from.
But it does say something about the context, and that context affects their perspective on the world. And I think, demonstrable, certainly based on my reading of what you've written, that we have paid a price, a substantive, a serious, and potentially, existential price, for that dominance, the belief that we will not tolerate any opposition in the world to American power. That seems very dangerous.
Well, we don't question the assumption.
Which is even more dangerous.
So a lot of the dispute, I mean, you know, whether, you know, for good, some of the career military people coming in have different views about the exercise of military power than the outgoing Bush administration. But the arguments really are about when to use military power, what's the right way to do it, should you use it for post-war reconstruction, and so on. It's still a military argument.
Yeah. There was a time when power meant, it still could mean, moral power.
Well, soft power.
Ethical power, diplomatic power. The middle countries have power, that is to say, those who are neither too big or just really big or really small. There are lots of kinds of power, but at the moment, and from what you both are saying, it's as if the only power is military, and then maybe a little economic, except look what America has just done to the economics of the world.
Well, you know, let me come back to the Cold War again, and a story that I try to tell in The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan. The Europeans have a completely different perspective on how the Cold War ended. And their perspective is emphasizes, well, if you're specifically German, it emphasizes West Germany's role in opening up to East Germany and Eastern Europe. But more generally, the Germans and others in Europe emphasize the role of what were called the Helsinki Accords in 1976, the idea that the Soviet Union was, through negotiations, signed on to an agreement that gave some standing for people to review the internal policies of the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe in dealing with their own people. And it gave, for the first time, some formality and some role to dissidents in Eastern Europe.
You forced me to go back and do a survey, a search last night, trying to find out the question I'm going to ask you, which is, do we have a reasonable guess of what the defense budget is?
Now?
Now. You know, 2008. Can you put a plus or minus number around that? Because it's really hard to pin
down.
You know,
you're gonna stump me. I would say it's $600 to $700 billion.
A year.
Yeah.
Right. There are estimates that go up to close to $1 trillion. And the problem, of course, is it's spread out in lots of different places.
Right.
And there have been all these off book.
Obama certainly. I mean, to his credit, said we're going to put the
numbers back in the budget.
Right.
Well, I mean, Afghanistan and Iraq were treated as part of the war on terror, which was not part of the defense budget.
Yeah.
Which meant that we simply didn't account for what...
Well, when you talked about the defense budget, and somebody said this is the defense budget, it didn't include a lot of things that any reasonable, I think, observer would put in that. So your guess is $600-700 billion?
At least.
At least,
and
yeah,
that is, at least at one point, more than all of the next 15 or 20 countries combined?
Yes.
It's awfully close to matching the
and growing?
The rest of the world.
The gap is growing, for sure, yeah.
Last time I looked, we were, depending on how you get the numbers, but some people were saying we were at 48 or 49% plus or minus of the total expenditures of the world on armaments.
Essentially, we
spend half as much. You know, we spend half of everything that's spent.
Let's come back in just a moment and talk about what the implications and complications of that are with James Mann. We'll be back shortly.